As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Mighty Manfred with you once more on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is country music artist Elizabeth Cook, who's also a disc jockey on our sister SiriusXM channel, Outlaw Country. Her latest album is Aftermath, and it features our recent coolest song in the world, Thick Georgia Woman. We'll hear some of that now, followed by my chat with Elizabeth on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Under clothes, she moves like a razor. She'll peel your heart. Thick Georgia woman, where do you start? She's gonna lock the door, take off a bra, call up her sister in Arkansas, pour her rides and a jar of wine, talk about class and decline. In her chest is a treasure trove, rich as the groceries on the stove. A world of hurt in the skies, happy as hell otherwise. Thick Georgia woman.
Mighty Manfred here, and joining me for our coolest conversations today is country music singer and radio host Elizabeth Cook. The song Thick Georgia Woman off her 2020 album Aftermath is our coolest song in the world this week. And she hosts Elizabeth Cook's Apron Strings Monday through Friday over on our sister channel, Outlaw Country. How are you, Elizabeth?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm hanging in there pretty good. And let's see, I want to make sure I've got this right. Not only are you on the air Monday through Friday on Outlaw Country, but you're on noon to 4 p.m. Eastern time, right?
Yes.
So you are not only on my sister station, I am the you and you are the me of our respective channels, right? Because I'm on the air at the same time.
We're pulling everybody through their afternoon together.
Well, I'm going to call you not just my sister DJ, but my DJ twin separated at birth. Okay. You all right with that?
Yep. I'm in.
All right. I'm from the Atlanta area, and when the world isn't locked down, I head there to visit family or work with my bandmates. And one of the guys lives in Grant Park, which is, and he lives not exactly a stone's throw from the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary there, but like a skipping stone. That's the one that held Al Capone. And more recently, they like took a lot of the prisoners out of there because so many of them were sneaking out and back in. I mean, did you hear about this? They literally were going out for lunch and then going back to prison. Did you know that?
At Atlanta Federal.
At the Atlanta Federal Pen.
No.
And, the reason I'm bringing this up is because I was, you know, looking up information on you, and I found out that your father had been incarcerated there for like moonshining or running moonshine. I know he's also a musician and he played with your mom. Can you tell us some about your family and your upbringing?
Yeah. Daddy had gone to jail. He ran moonshine with an organized crime ring. So it was kind of a big sting operation, and he did 8 years. He got shipped to Sumter County Correctional in Florida from Atlanta Federal to help build that jail after he got his welding certificate. And he played upright bass in that prison band there. They had a little prison band with some instruments and stuff. So when he got out, he met my mom. She was a hillbilly singer from Charleston, West Virginia. And she was really talented and great. And they had a little band together. They struck up a band, and then they fell in love and got pregnant with me. And they were both into their 40s at that point. And Yeah, it was on. I was born into that band, and I have 10 half-brothers and sisters, and they all, I know some of them better than others. Some of them are musical, some mostly not. But yeah, we're kind of a little motley crew.
Well, you mentioned, you said 10 other half-brothers and sisters, and your folks being forming a group together. You were on stage with them starting pretty young, right? Like around the age of 4, did you start performing with them?
Yes. Yes, I did. About 4 years old. And then by the time I was 8, I had like my own band, and my mom was writing little country songs for me to perform. And it was a whole thing.
So were you already playing guitar by the time you formed this this little group?
No, I didn't start doing that until college, really. Never really liked it that much. Still don't, really. It's an occupational hazard. I like to write songs, mostly. And I like to sing them with my band in front of people and have a good time making a bunch of, like, country rock and roll racket. You know, we have a good time. So I have warmed up to it. It helps me write songs, so I do it.
Well, I was going to say, so when you use that as the instrument to write songs with, not like a piano or something else.
Right, yeah. I've written some on piano, but not much. Mostly I had this little Casio keyboard that had all these drum beats on it, and I was like tired of just writing like 2-beat simple country songs. So yeah. I just started like punching in like the rumba beat or some really like things and just kind of like, you know, spitting lyrics over them to make different songs. And so that's a fun thing to do too, but well, not traditional piano, no.
Well, when I was looking up your stuff on you, I thought this was interesting that, so you got these, your country bands, your music happening in your life at beginning there at a young age. But you did go to college. If this is true, let me know that you wound up getting a degree. I think it's from Georgia Southern in accounting and computer information systems.
That's right. I double majored there at Georgia Southern down in Statesboro. Georgia folk may know of that school. It's like usually if you flunk out of Georgia, I think you go to Georgia Southern until you can turn it around and get back into. But no, I had a great time and great professors and got a great education there, and including how to do a keg stand. Had a really good time, and was just trying to kind of break out of the, you know, the rough and tumble honky-tonk music world that I had come up in. It was not the best place for a child, and you know, rife with traumas. So I think I was seeking to get away from it, and but my first real job was in Nashville. So I got to Nashville, and of course I had been there over the years, playing some, recording some. And boy, that accounting job sucked. I hated it so bad. So I got a little deal to write songs and took it. I was like, okay, I'm back in to music.
So years ago when I was actually in college, but I had a job and I worked as an auditing clerk, and this was at the Sears and Roebuck building in downtown Atlanta. And later they turned it into some sort of city hall annex. And it's like a huge, not like really tall, but just like really sprawling. And in that room, it was like a scene from that movie Brazil, where there were like well over 100 desks, like maybe 120, 150 desks, and they were giant desks. And it, on each one had like a giant adding machine on it, like if you were to drop something like that on somebody, it would kill them, you know? I mean, they're big, giant adding machines. And at the
like
end,
like the 10 key, they call them, like the little 10 key adding.
It was like a big giant machine, and the keypad, you know, the numbers you punch were like just the tiniest, took up the tiniest space on the front of this machine, you know? And at the end of the row, all the desks are facing the same way. At the end of the row, our supervisor, in my case, Ms. Allison, was staring, with her desk was pointed at us, right? So every time I look up, I could see her beaming down at me. What was sucking about your accounting thing?
Well, I always loved to, like, I loved the little 10 key machines, and I liked auditing. but I did not flourish in the corporate environment. Yeah. It was just more of a cultural thing. There's just no room for any sort of autonomy over how you did your job, how you dressed, where you went for lunch. It was just a very kind of straight and limited world, and not the environment that I wanted to spend so much time in. It's kind of squelched my little soul, you know, and so I couldn't really fit in. I wore the wrong clothes. I would create a spreadsheet when they didn't want me to create a spreadsheet. And it was just not a good fit.
So it's basically like a 100 degrees removed from all your life experience up to that point, right?
Totally. Yeah. Which is, you know, what I thought I wanted, at that time, because the other part had been so rough, but, yeah, it turns out, no, I was more comfortable in my, you know, trashy little honky tonk kingdom.
Well, so you got this publishing deal, you start writing songs, and now, gosh, your seventh album, Aftermath, came out last year in September. How weird was it having an album come out in the pandemic?
Really weird. And, you know, it's always weird because things change so rapidly, and how you do it, and yeah, what's important, and where you focus, and all those things, and your efforts of releasing an album and trying to get it exposed. It's like always changing. But yeah, in a pandemic, it was just sort of, it was like having one hand tied behind your back. But at the same time, I just felt like creatively, I had to move on.
Yeah.
And it may not have been like the best business move I could have made for my career, but I needed to do it so I could just keep moving forward creatively. And so I did it.
Well, Butch Walker produced it, and I'm thinking, this is Mr. Marvelous 3, Cartersville, Georgia guy, right, Butch
Walker? Yeah, that's right.
Had you worked with him before?
No, I had never met him. And I was lined up to do the record with some fancy producers that I love and respect. But I just couldn't get comfortable with it as I was sort of studying what the records that they were making and thinking mm-hmm. on these songs and how they were going to get, you know, flushed out in the studio once we have all the machines and the effects and the yeah. all the things and the possibility for overdubs and all those things that's like it's little taste, you know, and choices that you make. So I just couldn't get comfortable with that part of it. And I was talking to my friend Aaron Lee Tashjian about it, and he suggested Butch. And so Butch had produced an album that I was crazy over how it sounded, and that was Raylan Baxter's most recent album at that time. And I thought that the record sounded awesome from you know, the textures, the tones, the sensibilities of how it all was captured and how the songs were presented. So I really want, like, whatever emotion I'm trying to get across, just put through the goalposts, balls to the wall, in ways that I don't know how to do. So Butch, like, is the perfect guy to do that. He's just an absolute ninja in the studio. And I flew out to meet him and play. When I contacted him, he was like, well, send me some songs. And I didn't really want to do that. I'll just fly out there because I needed to meet him and get his vibe and see what his studio was like and all that stuff before I committed to, you know, making an album. So I went out there and it went great. It was awesome. And we like scheduled the sessions that day and then made the record about 3 months later, started tracking there at his Ruby Red in Santa Monica, and had a great time. Took my band, and he was very trusting in me. And we just had an awesome time doing it and can't wait to do it again.
So when was it recorded, in 2019 or 2018?
Yeah, January 3rd, 2019.
So these rock edges to some of the songs on the album, those were his touches, or was that kind of your vision all along?
Well, I think it was kind of my vision all along. I don't want to take too much credit because he did so much to really polish everything and make it the best that the songs could be. But I came in with that band, and we have been playing those songs live, and I have been playing those songs live. And there's just the most important thing to me is to serve the song and whatever the song needs to get for it to have the most emotional impact as possible. So that's just what the song's called for, and he is, Butch was the man to know how to do that.
Well, our coolest song in the world this week is Thick Georgia Woman.
And there's I can't believe that. That's so cool.
Well, that's, you know, the man chose that. The man knows. Little Steven is like, yeah,
wow,
that's,
you put the finger on that one. I know. I feel like my genie came out of the bottle or something. It's really cool.
Well, that's true. It's a genie with a bandana, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, there's a line in there that mentions Kevin Kenney, and he's in the video. Why name check Kevin in the song?
Kevin is like a rock and roll shaman to me, and not just me. I feel like he serves that for a lot of people. But the first time I met him, he was like this kind of magical overlord in my life. And any time that I had anything come up, you know, artist to artist, I could call him and talk to him. And he always had this sort of sage wisdom and way of settling the situation and giving me a perspective on the situation that soothed everything. I've called him broken down on the side of the road in Seattle in a snowstorm with strep throat, trying not to cancel a show, and, you know, great duress. So he's just a really important person to a lot of people. Of course, Driving and Crying was one of our luminary rock bands when I was at Georgia Southern, played Homecoming the year I graduated. And he's just super special, and his name rhymes with J.C. Penney. So, what are you going to do?
Well, I thought that might tie into it too.
It was also Georgia, you know.
Right, I thought that might J.C. Penney might tie into that as well. Yeah, I agree. Kevin is a very unique, very open, warm, very positive too. Whenever I've come in contact with him, and yeah, magical overlord.
Yeah, not in like an annoying way, like, oh, keep a positive attitude. Like, you know,
but a genuine. Like,
yeah, it's always genuine and it's always real, and he always understands where you are and has been there a million times.
So I have
there's
this
iteration.
I'll say this real quick. So I have a band, and it's called The Woggles, and now I've just now remembered we played only once at Georgia Southern, and we opened up for Driving and Crying down there. In fact,
but more specific, I wonder if I was there. I was probably too drunk to remember it, but
That would have been maybe around 97 or 98, 95.
Okay, I was
like
probably
that.
Just gone. I might have been or might have been just gone, but yeah.
The reason I'm bringing this up is that we played them with them later on at the Masquerade on a New Year's Eve, and they, you know, they'd asked us to play, and we were doing the sound check, and the sound guy there was a complete ass, and he was completely screwing us over, not putting anything in the monitors, and it was like, well, whatever, we're just going to get through this and get off stage. And Kevin was there, and he walked up and he said, wait a minute, this is not good. You guys can't hear. There's nothing going on here. Hey, it's a sound guy. It's like, you got to turn this up. Yeah. Oh, that sounds better. And then he went to the other. I mean, he went to each of the wedges and made sure that everything was there. And he was, in fact, at one point, he like was dragging a wedge, like, no, you guys can move this back. It's not a problem. I don't care. You know, we're just a three-piece on stage. We'll separate the wedges later. It's not a big deal. Let's go ahead and do that now. Let's get it sounding right, you know? And it was, of course, incredible. Now, when we went on, the guy just did everything he could do to screw us over anyway, I guess because he was embarrassed that he was called to task. But it was just an example of, you know, him just this genuine positive force. It's like, no, you know, we're going to do it right, and you know, you guys deserve better, and I'm going to make sure I can do whatever I can to make that happen. And
wow,
anyway, very cool guy.
We should make him a cape.
We should
a cape.
don't you do some stuff on your radio show where you're doing recipes?
Not a cake, a cape.
Oh, a cape? Like C-A-P?
He probably would rather have a cake. But
I thought you said we should bake him a cake.
Yeah, I will also make him a cake. But no, like a cape, you know, because he's just always saving the day.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, well, I thought cape, I was thinking like Dracula. I was thinking, well, that's kind of sucking the life force out of things, right? That would be kind of bad. Well, this character you create for Thick Georgia Woman, a really powerful, woman. And in the video for it, you use Atlanta poet and dancer of the exotic variety, Blondie.
Yes.
And I don't think you could have made a better casting decision there. Are you familiar with her haunt, the Claremont Lounge in Atlanta?
Yes. Yes.
How would you describe that?
Oh, just... golly, I'm trying to think of like a good way to honor it. But I mean, I think it's just it takes something that's kind of maybe seen by the outside world a lot as something that's dark, and just makes it this light, loving, open place. It's like it's just love. Like she's so loving, and the spirit that it puts around, you know, the adult entertainment world, and the whole vibe there is just so welcoming and loving and come one, come all, and it's beautiful.
My brother went there one time, and he said that she got mad at him because he wasn't paying enough attention. Like she had come over to the table and wasn't paying attention, so she maybe slapped him, but not like gave him a black eye, but in a friendly way, you know. But he said after that he was never going to not pay attention to anything she ever said or did again.
Right.
Yeah.
Get it together.
Yeah. So she's known for crushing beer cans with her anatomy. Have you ever seen that?
I haven't. She did offer it, I think, for an extra $75 or something on the video shoot that day. But we didn't want to tax her further, and were, you know, taking good care of her to be there, of course, for sharing her time and her talents and beauty and celebrity with us. So I have not personally witnessed this, no.
Why did you, how'd you guys think of her? What made you think that she would be perfect to sort of represent Thick Georgia Woman?
It was actually... I have to give credit. It was my boyfriend's brother that came up with the idea to, you guys should get Blondie to dance that video. I was like, oh, yeah, man, that is perfect. So it was actually someone else's idea that I grabbed immediately and chased down. And because I made the video with Alan Stedman, who works at Adult Swim, and I work with on the cartoon Squidbillies. So they're Atlanta-based folk, and so he had all the lines and knew exactly how to find her.
Very cool. So the album opens up with the song Bones, and we're talking about videos here for a moment. The video definitely works for me in this sort of pandemic world, you know, we're coming out of.
Oh, yeah.
You're walking around with this sort of, it's got the kind of Mad Max vibe going on. You got this baseball bat, and your outfits are sort of a dystopian chic. Pretty cool. Now the lyric in there, I'll wear your bones around my neck. When did that sentiment first pop in your head? Where'd you get those that idea from?
Well, I mean, it's quite literal. It's cremation jewelry, and it has my parents' ashes in it. So yeah, it's a quite literal, and it's something that I wear. It's like, I think it's in my purse pocket right now, but I usually always have it on. So yeah, it was sort of kind of like a song and a message for my parents, you know, after they passed. They knew, because they had me so late in life, they knew that they would probably die when I was relatively young. And I would be, you know, orphaned at that point in my life whenever it happened. And so I kind of wanted them to know that, you know, I was okay and was powering through. So that was what was behind that song.
How old were you when your parents passed?
Gosh, this stuff was in my 30s, you know. Yeah. So I was upright and weaned and all those things, but potty trained and weaned off. But yeah, still hard as a young adult, you know, to lose that foundation.
I agree. Your song "Bad Decisions" on the album. Now, how much of that is from observed behavior, and how much of you is in that?
That's mostly me, for sure. I wasn't really thinking on visualizing, you know, someone else or judging them. It's pretty autobiographical.
Well, I was checking your website for tour dates, and I saw that, so you're scheduled to play November the 13th and 14th. Do you have any other upcoming dates happening?
We're going to do some stuff next year. I mean, of course, we have Outlaw Country Cruise. That's sold out, been sold out. But we'll do some other things. So I started back in August, and we just decided that we would try to do just like two or three shows and then come home and go do two or three shows and come home, which is, yeah, it's all kind of like difficult. But just to kind of go fill the waters. I didn't want to like plan a super long tour and then one person in the band or crew gets sick and then we have to shut everything down and all that work was for nothing. So I just thought, we'll go do these little ones. So we've done that, and we did DC and New York and Portland and Seattle and LA and Joshua Tree and Phoenix and Texas. And so we just kind of dipped our toe into different quadrants of the country. And so I think that it went well. And I think that we will, in the spring, we'll be announcing a longer run and hitting some more places and finally get out there to get to go play this album with my band, you know?
Right. Well, the way you're describing the touring there, I call that the SEAL Team Strike Force. You know, you just go in and get out, you know, hit them and get out of there.
I wanted to call it the Hit It and Quit It Tour, but my manager was like, "It sounds like you're retiring." And I was like,
You mentioned the Squidbillies thing. I want to ask you about that, because I think that's in its final season right now. You voiced the character Tammy on it. How did you land that role?
Because of SXM and being on Outlaw Country, those guys heard my voice. They had a character that they were writing into the show that they needed a voice for and thought I might fit it. So I got to do that and then got to be a recurring character. They even came, the writers and the cast even came on the Outlaw Country Cruise and they wrote an episode around the Outlaw Country Cruise, and then the next year all came back again and we like showed the episode in the theater that we performed there in front of everybody, just like seated. So it was awesome. So been a lot of fun doing that show and made so many great friends, just brilliant people at Adult Swim, and Dave Willis and Jim Fourier, Alan Steadman, everybody, just wonderful, wonderful people to work with.
So here's something that's a bit more more fun I want to talk about here, because as I was looking up your stuff, like the YouTube popped this clip up of you playing with John Prine, a version of In Spite of Ourselves, and that was from like 2013, Dayton, Ohio. And we lost him last year due to COVID complications. Do you remember how did the duet come together? Do you remember doing that?
Oh, yeah. I remember every time I ever sang with John Prine, which was a handful. And it was because I was opening for him out on tour. Mm-hmm. I got to do that about four times, I think. And it's tradition to, you know, especially if it's a female opener, that you get to sing In Spite of Ourselves with him.
Yeah.
And then come out at the end and do Paradise. And so there's a couple of clips of us doing In Spite of Ourselves on YouTube. And it's, yeah, some of the finest moments of my career I could fathom having.
You said you had toured with them four times?
I played four shows.
Played four shows. Did you have any opportunity just to hang out some, to speak some?
A little here and there. I mean, more so we have like mutual friends, but I, you know, was very privileged to be invited to their home for barbecue here and there, and their New Year's Eve party at the Opry House. And so I did get to be around him in sort of, you know, group environments, and sit and talk about songs a little, not as much as I would have liked, of course. And then the last album on Aftermath, I mean, the last song on Aftermath is called Mary the Submissing Years, and it's a mirror parallel song to a song of John's called Jesus the Missing Years. So I wanted to write a song about Jesus's mother Mary to sort of mirror that song in her story. It's like a 6-minute song, so that was a big challenge to write, and something that had really burdened me that I needed to do for a long time. And I finally got my guts up to do it about 10 days before we went in to make the album. I wrote that song, and so he got to hear it before he passed, and he was pleased and impressed. And so that was an awesome thing as a writer to get to have that moment and bond with him.
Wow. Well, in fact, I'm so happy you brought up that particular song, Mary the Submissing Years, because that's not the only Mary on the album. The other is a half-hang Mary. So yeah. My original question was going to be like, how are these Marys related? But apparently they're quite different Marys.
They are, but so many Marys seem to have a similar experience. But, yes, this is this character, Half-Hanged Mary, is based on a poem by a woman named Margaret Atwood. She's a Canadian author that I just discovered when one of her books got made into a television series called Handmaid's Tale on TV. So she created Handmaid's Tale. And so I went down a rabbit hole about her because I thought it was such an incredible, creative, clearly fictional but also plausible story about, you know, the plight of women. And so I found her. I found this poem called Half-Hanged Mary, and it's about this woman that gets tried for being a witch back in the 1600s, but they could not convict her because they didn't have any evidence. They sent her back to her small town in Massachusetts, but the townspeople still detested her and were suspicious of her to the extent that they finally hung her, or attempted to hang her, and it didn't work. So she hung there all night. So the poem that Margaret Atwood wrote goes hour by hour, what she's thinking from her perspective as she's hanging there. So when they went and cut her down the next day, she literally walked off, and she lived for 14 more years in that town. So I wanted to write a song about what life was like in that town for her and the townspeople after that event, because then they were really scared of her because she didn't die and they tried to kill her. So they just decided they were going to let that slide, but it still was very awkward for everyone involved. So I wanted to write a song about it, and I wrote Half Hanged Mary.
Well, Elizabeth, thanks again for chatting with me on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you so much. It is so awesome to get to connect with you. And this is such an honor. I can't believe it. And, pinch me. And thank you. I appreciate it so much.
Well, we're going to take a listen now to Half Hanged Mary. It's Elizabeth Cook off Aftermath here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Was Half Hanged Mary from Elizabeth Cook here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. It's off her most recent album, Aftermath. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Elizabeth
for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Next time, I'll be picking the brain of Mark Plotty, who worked with David Bowie to produce the Toy album back in 2001. It was leaked to the internet in 2011, but on November the 26th, it will have a proper release as part of the David Bowie box set Brilliant Adventure 1992 to 2001. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.